This is the Debugging Work Podcast.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Derek Hatchard. I spent my career in the tech industry in companies large and small, so I've seen firsthand how much modern work can be a hot mess. This podcast is a chance to discuss ways to make work better. Let's get started. My guest today is Lino Caramanchari, a sociologist with a PhD focused in diversity and inclusion. Dr. Caramanchari has over 30 years of experience in the field. He is widely published and is an internationally sought after speaker, facilitator, and consultant. He is co-founder and head of behavioral sciences at Mesh Diversity, where his research underpins the Mesh Diversity software platform, which I'll be talking with Lino about during this podcast. Lino combines his education, research, and expertise to help organizations engage inclusion in a way that drives positive, sustainable, and measurable change. This is a great conversation, and we'll hear from Lino in just a moment after a brief word from our sponsor. This episode is sponsored by BotWorks. BotWorks is your company's new AI task force at a fraction of the cost of an in-house team. For a fixed monthly fee, you get guaranteed monthly capacity for new development on chatbots, integrations, tools, and workflow automations, while BotWorks handles all the ongoing maintenance. And you can cancel at any time and take your code with you. BotWorks gives you the expertise of industry-leading engineers for less than the cost of a single junior developer. Take your company from the internet age to the intelligence age. Go to botworks.dev and save 40% on your first month. That's botworks.dev, and tell them that Derek sent you. Hey, Lino, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Derek. I'm happy to be here. Appreciate it.
I just would like to start with a little bit of an overview of the work that you do. You've written some books. You're working with a company right now that you co-founded. Just tell us a little bit more about what that looks like and how your background informs the work that you do.
I spent, I guess, at this about 13 years of formal education digging into the social science that underpins social oppression, you know, all the wonderful things like racism and sexism, heterosexism, stuff like that. And I came out of that degree with a fancy, polished, shiny PhD and a real good attitude that I was going to change the world. So I started my own consulting company. And you know, I think, yes, for about 13 years, I did a lot of what I thought was really good work until, much to my chagrin, I discovered that if I left an organization or if the organizational champion left, things would just kind of go back to what they were. So that was untenable for me because I genuinely wanted to do, you know, real social change kind of stuff. So I got together with one of my co-founders, Mike Wright, who had, you know, spent, I think at that point in time, probably 20 years in software development. And we created the software that we now call Mesh Diversity, which underpins the company Mesh Diversity, along with our other co-founders.
And before we talk about Mesh too much, can you give me an example of the type of consulting engagement that you would have done? Like, what type of company brought you in, and for what was the outcome that they were looking for, and what would happen when, you know, if you left and the organizational champion left? Like, paint a picture about sort of how things built up and how they might devolve.
For sure. So the type of company, sort of agnostic as to the type of company, sector, industry, that was irrelevant. That was all over the place. Did a lot of work. I would say maybe more than 60% of the work was inside of social services, government, things like that. A typical engagement would not have been uncommon for me to do kind of an organizational audit to establish the readiness for change, like where they were, what was the degree of inclusion in their systems and their processes, all of those things. Usually did an awful lot of training. That would have been one of the main things that would change today. And essentially just kind of function as a consultant to help them kind of implement the recommendations that were found in that audit. The main thing that would happen if I left, or if the champion left, well, there are different fall downs. If I left, then the drive, kind of the linchpin for the change process would go, because I was the one who was leading everything, right? So I discovered in that there's generally got to be somebody internal who's who's driving. If the organizational champion left, then all of a sudden resources would disappear, right? So those are the big fall downs. But then there was a challenge in doing DEI at the time, because there was no way to synthesize everything. There was no way to ensure that training was making a difference. There was no way to ensure that culture was changing as a result of training. There was no way. So what you're able to do today, because we're really combining data analytics and AI and the social science into this lovely little package that can really not just peer into the reality of what's going on, but do some predictive work and establish benchmarks. And so you can see in real time what's actually happening in a way you couldn't do it 20 years ago. Just couldn't. Quite frankly, you couldn't have done it 5 years ago.
Tell me more about what the software does and how it complements the rest, like the other parts of the engagement model that you have with companies today.
So Mesh really is first and foremost. Like I think, you know, there was an article that came out in the National Post just yesterday. I only saw it because a friend of mine texted me and said it. He texted me the article, and his caption was, "There's always going to be pushback to DEI." The article, the title of it was DEI Initiatives Not Supported by Empirical Evidence, Canadian Researcher Says. Right? So the funny thing is, the article itself is, you know, in my opinion, fairly politicized and slanted, but the research is sound, and we've been saying the same thing for 15 years. The way DEI has traditionally been done is deeply flawed, just deeply, deeply flawed. And in large part, it's the failing of my field. It's the failing of the sociological field, because we got really good, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, we got really good at understanding how social oppression worked. We got really good at understanding how it worked in systems, who benefited from it, who suffered as a result of it. And then we got really good at kind of pointing fingers and saying, so that's what's going on, and these types of folks are benefiting from it. And we didn't do a whole lot of work around, so this is how you manage it. This is how you manage it at a personal level, at a professional level. We didn't do a whole lot of work around that. So the approach to DEI coming from that lens became uber politicized and really did an awful lot to create sort of an us versus them mentality to how DEI was done. So much so that the D got pushed way, way, way in front of the E and the I. And again, I have no clue how well people understand the acronym itself. So maybe it's worth even exploring.
Yeah, yeah. Let's unpack it a little bit. Yeah.
So, I mean, the D is just the bodies, right? It's the differences within the bodies and the experiences those bodies have. So whether it's racism, sexism, heterosexism, life experience, all those things that make us different and unique as human beings. Think of the E as the system in which those bodies live. How equitable is that system? Is there equal opportunity, equal access? What is the system that you're in? The I is how those different bodies interact with each other within that system. Do we interact in a way that we're actually going to get the best out of each other? Is it genuinely inclusive? Do people feel belonging with each other? Do we feel safe with each other? You know, the best metaphor is it's sort of like we're the fish and we're swimming in the water. The water is the system. And really the tale is, are we swimming as a school together, or are we just like sporadically swimming out there in the water all alone? And when DEI is done well, we get to swim together. We get to swim forward together, and no one's swimming in anybody else's wake. So DEI done well really pushes the equity and the inclusive behavioral piece out front. And if you can do that, then a lot of the friction that's out there, it sort of goes away. And that is the key. There's a science to doing it. It has everything to do with how you build cultures of safety, belonging, and inclusion within an equitable system. And you got to be able to measure it. You got to be able to measure it in the right way for the right purpose. And if you can't do those last two things, measure it in the right way for the right purpose. You can do good work, but how do you know you're doing good work?
If someone is listening to this conversation, they're a manager or they're in an influential position, can you speak a little bit more to why should they care? So the analogy of fish swimming in a school together, it's a nice analogy. But if someone is listening and they're going, well, I'm just here to do my part and generate some revenue for the company, why do I care about this at all?
Yeah, for sure. I think the question brings up a murky problem that people don't really think about. Because when DEI has, again, in the traditional manner in which DEI has been done, it almost sits off in a silo as a nice to have, right? The easiest way to kind of explore the why should a manager engage DEI is to say, have you ever had a micromanaging boss? If you have, and if it's a Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 job, you know your stress starts on Sundays between 3 and 5 o'clock. Because on Sunday between 3 and 5 o'clock, a little piece of your brain called the amygdala sends off a warning sign that essentially says, you're going to go to sleep, you know, shortly after you have dinner and maybe read a book or something, you're going to sleep. And when you wake up, you're going back there. And it starts to put your body into an elevated baseline level of stress, preparing you for the next event. And depending on how long you work with that micromanaging boss, heart-related diseases, stress-related diseases, hypertension, all sorts of lovely things, right? And that's all in relation to one individual in a given space for a period of time. You know you got to work with them. So in some ways, you can develop a degree of steel to it, right? Because I know I got to go there. Well, when's the next time I'm going to experience racism? Who's it going to come from? How long will the duration of the event be? Personal experience, professional experience, impact my family, impact my job. When you don't know from where, from whom, how long, there's no way to develop that steel, right? So the question becomes, if we understand the importance of building team spaces, workplaces where people are psychologically safe, like organizations don't seem to have a problem with that, right? If you have an organization that recognizes the value of psychological safety, they have an advantage over their competition who don't, period. Because the team environment, the work environment they build will be far more innovative, far more collaborative, because people will feel safe to be able to risk, right? Well, if you understand that, then it's not a further step to recognize the moment you start looking at that through a diversity lens, it's not just the micromanaging boss. It's what if I come into a workplace and I'm not sure whether I'm being treated in a manner that's equitable? Like, am I really not being heard in this meeting because the supervisor's super interested in the other person's position? Or is it because I'm a woman? Or is it because I'm Black? Because there are all sorts of kind of impacts in that space. Like the simplest one to understand is something called stereotype threat. You got to be assertive to get ahead in the work world. Well, what do we call assertive women? Well, assertive white women are bitchy. Assertive Black women are angry Black women. Assertive Black men are aggressive. And so the way stereotype threat works is if you know the stereotype's there, I don't want to live into the stereotype. So I'm going to couch myself. I'm not going to speak up because I don't want to be perceived that way. Well, then hell, what happens next time there's a promotional opportunity? Well, I don't really see Lino as, you know, leadership material. He's not assertive enough, right? So there's a domino effect outside of people not being able to be innovative, not wanting to collaborate, not feeling safe to stretch. It expands into how you just are in all sorts of different scenarios in the organization. So for any organization that recognizes the value of psychological safety in team building, in innovation, in collaboration, in performance, your advantage over your competition that doesn't is that much less over the competition that recognizes that and recognizes how it ties into DEI.
Oh, there's a piece of me, Lino, that just wants to just sort of keep prodding and just let you talk nonstop. Cause all I want, I feel like I'm sort of sitting here just absorbing a ton of wisdom.
Please tell that to my wife and my kids. Please.
We'll send them that clip. We'll pull that little clip out.
Another life lesson, Dado, please. Please talk to my children.
When an organization brings you in, do you normally have the right stakeholders engaging with you? You had made a point earlier about sort of often DEI is off to the side. I would say that I have seen that in corporate environments that I've been in where it's kind of this thing. and it didn't feel central to the culture. And I'm curious if the types of companies and other types of organizations that you are engaging with, is it the executive team coming saying, I want to make my company better and give us a competitive advantage? Or is it starting from that side and part of your mission is as a company is to try to use that as a wedge to drive deeper into whole organizations?
You know, it's funny. It's, again, it's a really interesting question. It doesn't usually come from the spaces people would think it would come from. Like, so you might think, particularly after George Floyd, and there was this explosion of hirings of DEI leaders and chief diversity officers and the like, you would think that would have been the time that people would have said, hey, let's go get a hold of Mesh and get some metrics in here and do this based in science. But there's a reality to this. The vast majority of DEI leads, if they're in larger organizations, there's massive levels, right? You might be the DEI lead, but you have no connection to hiring. You might be the DEI lead, but you have no connection to talent. You're not necessarily connected to HR. So oftentimes you still sit in this little siloed space. Your portfolio may include like support for ERGs or bring some training in for this, do a celebratory event. So it really depends on where that individual sits in the organization. If the DEI lead actually has a portfolio with teeth, with resources, with access to, you know, the executive team that'll actually hear them, on those occasions we've been brought in through them. But the moment you come down from that, the DEI lead doesn't usually have the ability to bring in a whole system that's going to touch the entire organization. So when it's the organization that's bringing us in so we can actually put real data science into play and really look at culture and really help them change, it's usually going to be from the HR department because they're kind of systems mandate, right?
I want to talk more actually about the software does in a moment. Is it more common that you get brought in for a whole company or do you end up in kind of like business units or division type of engagements?
On occasion, we've been brought in for a business unit here or there. But I, you know, the success of the implementation is usually when it's brought in, you know, company-wide. And you know, our wheelhouse, like we have some exceedingly large clients, but our wheelhouse tends to be in the 500 to 1,000-ish person just because it's less glacial. And fewer silos, and right. It's just easier to kind of move things through. And there's so many factors. We're vertical agnostic for that reason. There's so many factors, and there's so many different ways we can come in because the software does so many things. If you have an organization that's really just interested right now, we have our DEI stuff going forward in the way that they want to, not necessarily the way that it's going to work, but it's the way that they want to. But they recognize, hey, we want to be able to do something and make our hiring or recruitment or interview questions more inclusive, more equitable. Then I would call it a plugin. I'm sure my CTO would yell at me if I called it a plugin. there's an application in the platform that can help with that. We have a fairly powerful LLM, which is a large language model. Like we've stood up our own ChatGPT instance within the platform. So we can support all sorts of pretty powerful analytics underneath. So we can work with people's existing interview questions to connect to their own metrics to make them more equitable. So there's so many things we can do just with that. If you're looking at leadership development, we have an aspect of the platform that puts personal metrics on for leaders and actually drives recommendations that are based on data analytics. So we can, you know, predictively say, hey, if you want to improve here and here, do this and this. So there's some pretty cool things that underpin the platform.
Let's talk a little bit about what's a typical engagement and implementation. And then I want to circle back if we don't run out of time to talk about that leader piece in particular, because I think that kind of lit up my brain a bit. Yep. But what's a typical engagement? So someone has engaged with Mesh Diversity. what happens next?
Rather than saying what's a typical one, let me say what would probably be the optimal approach.
Okay.
Because there is no typical, to be honest. We come in from a whole bunch of different angles depending on what the client needs, because every client's different, right?
Sure. Okay.
But in a best case scenario, when the executive leadership is on board, there's an equity systems piece. Remember when I said the D, the E, and the I? You want to ensure that you're building equity into the system, right? So we have a consulting aspect so that we can kind of walk hand in hand with our partners. So that includes some DEI visioning, goal setting, action plan development, ongoing support for the development and execution of their diversity committee, right? So there's all of those pieces that are kind of part of it.
Is there anything that happens before that? Like, what informs that consulting piece when you're sort of understanding the organization and its current state?
In a perfect world, there's a couple of different pieces to it. Like, if you go onto our website, we have access to a maturity model that inside of about 3 minutes of answering a fairly cool little questionnaire, you get an essential assessment of where your organization sits in terms of its readiness for change. Think of it as its future readiness for engaging DEI.
And who's the ideal persona to do that?
It should be somebody who has some knowledge of what's going on. So HR would be fine. C-suite would be good. If you have enough to be able to answer the kind of what is going on in the organization, what steps have we taken so far, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
If you can intelligently speak to that, then you do the maturity model. So if we're equipped with the maturity model, then best case scenario, we do a run through with our benchmark metrics. So the benchmark metrics are really designed to give you a snapshot in time of the degree of safety, belonging, inclusion in the organization. And we can break that down to team level. We can take the safety down into its five constituent elements. We can look at it down at that level. We can splice and dice by race and gender and all of those things to give a really nice snapshot of how people feel. It's completely anonymous. Like, you'd have to break our system in order to find who said what. Like, it's completely anonymous. But we can look, we can create longitudinal data. So if you do the benchmark, you know, 6 months from now, a year from now, you can understand how the teams have moved, what established really clear recommendations for all those things. And the amazing thing is, A, it can't be gamed. So, you know, after George Floyd, every well-meaning person on the planet with access to an engagement survey has turned it inward and asked questions like, do you feel belonging on your team? Because people were hurting after that. The problem is it's a misuse of a tool that was not designed to do what we think it's doing. So the simplest way to look at that, a Likert-style survey was designed as a social.
I know what that is, but can you explain what that is for anyone who doesn't know what that means?
Sure. So Likert-style survey is that 1 to 5, 1 to 10, strongly agree, strongly disagree kind of survey, right? It was designed for social research. So I could go to, hey, Derek, on a scale from 1 to 10, 10 being awesome, 1 being I think he's a bag of dirt, how do you feel about Justin Trudeau, right? Like, you, and if I ask you that, you have no fear in answering, right? Because it's not going to impact you, your job, your family. It's just, you are essentially an anonymous piece of a very, very large survey. But the moment you employ Likert-style surveys in an organization, all sorts of things come into play. Like, we lie. We lie to avoid stress, curry favor, avoid tension. Like, there was some research came out a couple of years ago that said in Western countries, people tend to stay away from the edges in Likert surveys because they feel too extreme. You could be the most sexist guy on the planet. If you have a female boss and I ask you, how do you like working with Emily? Oh, she's a 10. Oh, don't worry, Derek. It's anonymous. You can be honest. Absolutely. She's a 10 because you don't want to get in trouble. Right?
Right.
So we had to develop a methodology, and it took about 6 years to develop an approach that A, couldn't be gamed easily, and B, could dig into some of those things that you would not normally get information out in terms of DEI. Like, the moment you ask questions of people that are about their identity,
that would reflect poorly either to other people or for themselves, again, we lie. So the survey is pretty unique, exceedingly simple to use. You can run through the whole thing in about 3 minutes.
Can you give an example
of how?
So someone can sort of vision what it is as opposed to just a basic Likert scale.
For sure. So a basic Likert scale would be people on our team engage each other in a manner that is collegial and productive. Strongly disagree, neutral, agree, strongly agree. Right? That's your options.
Right.
So if you're my micromanaging boss, I know how to answer that question. Of course, the answer you want to hear is strongly agree, right? Whereas a mesh question might be, on our team, we tend to engage each other in a manner that is A, straightforward and courteous, B, calm and reasonable, C, assertive and no nonsense, D, clear and frank. Now, depending on who you are, one of those could be the right answer. Because you don't know what is being assessed, so for instance, am I trying to find out if the team is courteous? Am I trying to find out whether the team is no nonsense? If I think no nonsense is the right answer, then no nonsense is the right answer. I think being reasonable isn't that is. So because there's no way to know what is being asked, you can't really game the answer. So you might as well just answer the way you feel about it, right? All of those questions are plumbing into the constituent elements of safety, belonging, inclusion. So what you get is some pretty good data. The challenge with the other methodology is, you know, if I asked you, if we had 10 people on this podcast and I said, picture an elephant, you'd all picture different elephants. Some might be a cartoon, some might be, you know, real, some might be African, some might be Indian, some might be, you know, moving, some might be standing still. So what do you think happens when I ask a question like, do you feel belonging on your team? It's a nonsense question. Unfortunately, even though it's a nonsense question, if you believe it's a real question, then you end up working with bad data without knowing you're working with bad data. So our process is designed to A, use the science to get to what is really happening on a team relative to safety, belonging, and inclusion. The process is exceedingly easy, and what you get is exceedingly robust. Not just the metrics in front of you, the longitudinal nature of it, but the real recommendations that come out of the say, based on the data science, this is what you want to do to improve.
How does that part of the engagement work? So you've gathered information from the organization. You now have recommendations. Is this your team, or does the software guide me to some sort of canned systems that I should be putting in place?
Yeah. So for instance, I think it's the newest enhancement. I think it's being released shortly. Like if you take part in say the inclusive leadership program, you get your own personalized metrics. So there's 36 diversity keys or inclusion keys. On your own platform, the recommendations will be right there. So you can dig into the metrics if you want, but the recommendations are already there for you. Like our dev teams have got it. So all of the science is in the background. You don't see it, but it pulls out the recommendations for you right in front of you.
If someone is highly skeptical, can I, you know, drill in and say, like, educate me more? Why did you recommend this to me?
Well, so the what you can do is everything in the platform is designed to be click-through. So there's four main pillars. The underpinning of the platform is emotional intelligence. There's a huge dovetail between DEI and emotional intelligence. You know, the simplest way to see the connection is, human beings, we judge ourselves by our intent, and everybody else judges us by our impact. It's part of the reason that you can have the guy, you know, make the sexist joke. And if a woman says, I didn't appreciate that, he can easily, well, I didn't mean it that way. You shouldn't take it that way. You're being too sensitive. He judges his intent. Everybody else lives in the impact, right? So what our personal development process actually does is allows you to see the gap between your intent and your impact. So the four main pillars of it, the first main pillar is how well you see yourself. It's really looking at self-awareness.
This is me as a leader compared to what the people on my team are saying?
Well, so there's four. The four pillars are, first pillar is personal baseline. This is how well you know yourself. The second pillar is, say, the performance keys. This is whether you get the most out of yourself, particularly under stress or duress.
Okay.
The third pillar is what we call the communication baseline. This is where the sociology really starts to come in. Think of it as your social footprint. how you impact the people around you. And then the fourth pillar is they're all the leadership keys. Are you seen as somebody who is who follows through on their commitments? Are you principled? Can you coach with candor? Are you approachable? Are you appreciative? Do you influence? Influence is one of those things that a lot of folks don't pay attention to, and maybe they should. Good leaders don't push, they don't pull, they're willingly followed. Mm. And so how well do you influence the people around you? And so each of those pillars have kind of subcategories within them. So in the personal baseline pillar, there's self-awareness, self-acceptance, self-assessment. In the performance keys, it's engagement, problem-solving, resilience. In the communication baseline, it's social awareness, relationship-building, rapport. And in the leadership keys, it's integrity, role modeling, and climate setting. So in any one of those, you can dig into. It's just a click, and all the information comes up in front of you. There's video content to support the learning. There's e-learnings that are attached to all of our inclusive leadership models that are pretty cool. They got a really handsome guy to do a lot of the video content. If you can figure out who that is.
Well, that's how we know it wasn't me. That's the... I recognize that we're already pushing up on our time, and there's so much more I would like to ask. You just hit on, I've heard you say this, actually I should give the background. So I originally encountered your work. I was doing consulting and you did some training and implemented the software at the company I was consulting with. And your comment about we experience intent and everyone else experiences the impact is one of the things that really stuck with me. Let's assume there are people listening who this is their first encounter with you. What other things would you want to leave them with to trigger their thinking and to help move them along in sort of the maturity model to be ready for something like mesh diversity?
You know what? I'm going to poo-poo on my field a little bit, I think. And I want to build on the pieces that we discussed earlier. Number one, we don't live in a vacuum. We just don't. You know, half of the folks who listen to your podcast might be like, if you have, this is easier to do with Americans. If you have American folks who listen to your podcast, 50% of them might watch Fox News and 50% of them might watch MSNBC, right? And you get very different worldviews out of those two media content. So we don't work in a vacuum. So the unfortunate reality is people will come to the work already primed to see it either as something that's beneficial or as something that's scary. The challenge is the way that DEI has been done traditionally, it makes people who are positioned as being in a position of social power. So if you're white, if you're male, if you're straight, if you're able-bodied, all that, it almost makes you feel like you got to walk on eggshells. For fear of making a mistake. And for folks who are minoritized, who live every day with things like racism and or sexism and or heterosexism, etc., it has been done in a manner that almost teaches you to feel more vulnerable, teaches you that everything is potentially a slight, everything is potentially dangerous, and that it's done with intent. That's the worst piece. There's research just from last year. I'm trying desperately to remember the name of the researchers. But if I step on your foot, it will hurt. If you believe I did it with intent, it will hurt more. And so what has happened in with the combination of social media and the internet where everybody can feel like they're an expert, this thing called reality testing has disappeared. Like way back in the day, if you and I were at a bar and you said something that I didn't like, I could call you a jerk and you might punch me. And I would learn, hey, maybe when you're out at a bar, don't call people names because you're going to get punched. It's reality testing. You learn thing. I don't want to do that anymore, right? Yeah. But on the internet, I can say all sorts of things. And A, there's no ramification for me. And B, I can find a community of people who will support what I said. So on the internet, there's all manner of nonsense that's out there, just nonsense. And there is no need to do any kind of reality testing. So the way DEI has been practiced, unfortunately, is very much that I say this over and over again. I'm going to say it until the day I die. traditional DEI practitioners are sort of like kids in school who fail the test and blame the teacher. Oh, the teacher hates me. It was an unfair test. Well, maybe you should have studied. In the same way, if your idea of doing DEI work or DEI training is to take a straight white middle class able-bodied guy who's never looked at social oppression, never looked at what hierarchies are, what patriarchy is, what privilege means, never done any of that stuff, put him in a room in a mandatory training, throw a book called White Fragility on the desk in front of him and say, hey, start reading from this chapter. Are you surprised that he chafes? Are you surprised that he either gets anxious and or angry? Again, it's like throwing somebody in the deep end of the pool when they don't know how to swim and being surprised that they're mad at you. So like the approach to DEI has just been fundamentally flawed. It positions people in positions of social power as the enemy and minoritized peoples as fundamentally violable. And neither one of those is tenable. So I think that's the big thing that I would say. DEI, when it is done well, it does not need to cause this kind of friction. Because at the end of the day, like when you were a little kid, did your parents or your caregivers go, oh, I really, really hope this little boy grows up to be insular and selfish and self-absorbed, and I hope he doesn't care if he hurts other people? Like, there's no chance in hell anybody's parents ever said that. But somehow we have this world where people are learning it's okay not to give a damn about how other people feel and how we impact them. And it's not what made us the apex species on this planet, right? It's just not. We're building divisions unnecessarily. So the tie-in is when DEI is done well, it does not need to cause this kind of friction. But the way it has traditionally been done, it's almost been designed to do it without people recognizing it.
Why is that?
I think largely because understanding a little bit of the science is one thing. You know that whole thing about a little bit of knowledge can be a dangerous thing?
Yeah.
So I think for the folks who started to bring it out of academia into the real world, they got some of the science piece, leveraged it from a political perspective, and didn't really understand human psychology or social psychology. What's going to happen when I do X? How will someone respond? Like, you know, the perfect example is, I don't know, have you ever heard of a concept called call out culture? Call out culture.
No.
So if you're in a team meeting and a guy in the meeting says something that could be construed as sexist, call him out, right? That's sexist. We don't talk like that here, right? For some folks, that's allyship. That's the way you stand up for minoritized people. That's the way you ensure that things like sexism stop, right? Well, do you like being told you're wrong, Derek?
No. I am used to it, but I am not a fan of it.
But you don't like it, right? Do you like being told you're wrong in public? Probably less so.
Yeah.
Would you imagine liking being told that you're racist in public? Probably not. So as a human being, you're going to have reactive tissue. And that reactive tissue is either going to be, do I eat it or does it eat me? You will snap into fight or flight so bloody fast, it will make people's heads spin. And so unfortunately, and I want to be really careful when I say this, because a lot of the impetus for the approach comes from a place of pain. Like when you have been put upon your whole life and nobody listens to you and nobody seems to care about the pain, when you finally have an avenue to say, okay, I get to do something about it, unfortunately, that empathy muscle gets flexed a little bit less, right? And there's a really, really strong correlation between traditional applications of power and that experience of kind of like a temporary power. When you go into, say, juvenile detention facilities, one of the most powerful things you can have, say, a young black guy do to his white jailer, call him a racist. Because in that second, it's super powerful. Oh, no, I'm not. No, I'm not. Yeah. Feels powerful for a second, but he's still the one in the cell, right? It can feel powerful, but it hasn't really done much. So there's recent research that also suggests that when you are in a power position, you do actually flex your empathy muscles less. Mm-hmm. And there's evolutionary design behind it. If 200,000 years ago, if we're part of a tribe and you got a bat, I need to pay attention to how you feel about me. If you don't have a bat, I care much less. If you're the person with the bat, you probably don't even notice how I feel. You can extrapolate that to micromanagement really easily, right? Micromanagers aren't usually out to just make people's lives miserable, right? They just don't notice. But when your micromanaging boss walks in the room, you know exactly how they're feeling. And odds are you're amplifying it in your own head and being worried about things oftentimes you might not need to be worried about. And so in that respect, am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
You know, I haven't decided. You go ahead. I'll beep it out.
I was at the tail end of one of our inclusive leadership programs with one of our organizations. And there's a young woman, self-identified lesbian, sixth session. We're in the communication module. About 20 minutes left in our last module. We've spent 6 hours together. And she says the following: I've loved the program. It's been awesome. I've learned so much. Everything makes sense. I'm struggling with something. I'm struggling with this idea that I don't say just what I want to say. Because you know why? I've had to couch everything I feel my whole life. And I had to spend 10 minutes saying, I hear the pain. Like, I hear where you're coming from. What's it doing for you? Where's it going to get you? How's it going to help any kind of movement? We have to move past this. And again, it's unfortunate because a lot of it has been bred from this lack of need to reality test, what social media has done, because everyone will say you're right about anything you do. Like, you'll find a community that says you're right about whatever you do, that me, 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 my needs, my needs, my needs. And even when you're people who deserve to be heard, it doesn't mean that everything you have to say is what should be said at any time you want to say it. You know what I mean? The field is exceedingly challenged with this approach that now is being deemed as woke, right? That's the new boogeyman out there. And a lot of it has to do with DEI being engaged in a way that really, really does genuinely cause friction. And I can't remember if it was another podcast or if it was an interview, but someone said, so in the light of this new pushback to wokeness, what are you guys doing differently at Mesh? And I looked over at my co-founder, Mike, and I'm like, we don't do anything differently. We do it exactly like we always did, because we never took that approach. That's the farthest thing from what we've ever done. So yeah, we're in a peculiar place that the world seems to be pushing back, hopefully, to exactly where we need to be.
Something that I really respect about you is I see some of the conversations that you engage in on LinkedIn where you challenge almost the starting assumptions about how people are thinking about things like quote unquote wokeness or, you know, approaches to DEI. And I just want to say how much I respect the courage and bravery that you exhibit, because the internet is a terrible place. and I think your voice is both super, super important, but super instructive. We are way past time, but I don't want to stop listening to you talk, but we're coming up to our cutoff time. So I do want to transition to our lightning round. I've got three questions for you. They'll be fast. First of all, what is a book, podcast, or video that you recommend to people?
I'm going to be super self-serving. Sometime in the next 7 months, my new book is going to be out. It is called The Old Black Lesbian Elephant in the Room, Why the Woke Need to Wake Up. And it really is digging into a lot of the conversations we had today. You can be a person with all of the best intentions, but if your approach is not just divisive, but self-defeating, it's probably an approach you want to rethink.
And we're recording February 2024. So depending on when someone is listening to this, it may already be out.
No, it's definitely not out.
It's not out today. Check the show notes. When it is out, I will update the show notes so that there's a link to it. Sure. All right, Lino, is there a person, place, product, or thing that you would like to shout out today?
The McKenna Institute is doing some amazing work in the digital sector in New Brunswick. And the partnership that we have with them and UNB
is allowing for a first of its kind program in UNB's computer science department. We're doing some groundbreaking work integrating DEI and preparing students to be better members of the community and leaders when they graduate. So it's super exciting.
Oh, that's awesome. And I'll put links to the McKenna Institute and UMB, which for those people who don't know, is the University of New Brunswick, which is my alma mater. Finally, what is the most important superpower to develop in the modern workplace?
The conversation we had earlier about stress, good stress, as a leader, there is no better superpower than to build team spaces where all of your people can thrive. And that means building a space where there's the right amount of stress so you can get peak performance. There is no better superpower for leaders.
That's a great answer. I've been thinking about something I call urgent intensity, which I think is related to that idea of like just the right amount of good stress so that you get stuff done. Don't want to be too relaxed, you lose your competitive advantage.
Absolutely.
This has been wonderful. Thank you for your time. If people want to connect with you somewhere in the digital realm, where's the best place for them to find you?
LinkedIn is easy.
Okay.
If not, they can always reach out to support@meshdiversity.
All right. And we'll put links in the show note as well. If someone thinks that their company is ready for mesh diversity, what would be the next best step for them to take?
Just hop right to the website. Do your maturity model. That'll give you lots of info. You don't even have to interact with us, I think, to do it. It'll give you lots of good intel on your organization. And just hit somewhere in there, there's a hot button that'll allow you to kind of link in a meeting or something like that with us.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you, Leonardo. I very much appreciate your time and for running a little bit long. This has been wonderful. Thank you.
Appreciate it, Derek. Cheers. Thanks so much.
This has been the Debugging Work Podcast. Find show notes at podcast.debuggingwork.com.